Hi, everyone. It's Janice, host of the Divorcing Religion podcast. Thanks for tuning into my show, whether you're joining me on audio or video. I've heard from some folks recently who have told me just how much the show has meant, and some of them have even found it not only to be life-changing, but life-saving, as they felt there was no one else who understood what they were going through, and they found the Divorcing Religion podcast, and they started feeling encouraged. Please help me keep my show on the air. Become a member by clicking the join button on the Conference on Religious Trauma YouTube channel. Thanks. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Divorcing Religion podcast. I'm your host, Janice Selby. I'm a registered professional counselor and a religious recovery consultant. My guest today is Hannah Abbasi. Hannah and I are both fellows in the Borgenicht Fellowship through the Rights and Religions Forum. The fellowship supports advocates and activists helping people who have left insular religious groups. When I heard Hannah's story, my jaw dropped, and I wanted you to hear her story too, because it's amazing. Hannah is a transplant to New York City from Austin, Texas. As an adult, she has also lived in Qom, Beirut, and Cairo. At the University of Texas in Austin, Hannah studied religious studies, Middle Eastern studies, and history, with a minor in Arabic language. She went on to study at Islamic seminaries in Iran and Lebanon. She completed her Master's of Science in Education in New York in 2018. Hannah went on to found An-Nas. An-Nas is an ethics-based community for humanists from Muslim backgrounds dedicated to providing opportunities for personal growth, promoting social justice, and contributing to an inclusive multicultural humanism through engagement with the arts, sciences, and humanities in intersectional spaces. Hannah brings to An-Nas her experience in the secular Muslim community as a former city organizer and an executive board president. She's also socially and politically active and believes in building bridges across lines of faith and culture, and I feel so lucky to have you here today. It's nice to see you again, Hannah.
Thank you, Janice. That was really lovely. Thank you for introducing me.
Your story is, I just found it mind-blowing, really, really interesting. And another thing that really made me want to interview you is you are a person who rolls up your sleeves and just gets things done. If you see a need, you're doing what you can to fill that need. And I feel that's the way that I live my life also. And it can be very tiring sometimes. And it's nice to connect with someone else who also has a humanist philosophy of life. So if you would, tell us a little bit about your growing up and the role that religion played and whatever else you think is significant for us to know about you and your story.
Sure. Yeah. I'll go ahead and get started with childhood stuff, and then I'll let you ask questions and jump off from there and that sort of thing.
Sure.
So I'm Hannah Abbasi. And as you can tell from my name, it's a little bit of mixed cultures already. So my father is from Pakistan and my mother is kind of the typical white American mixture. And they met when I was younger. She wasn't aware at the time, but she was actually his second wife, and his first wife was still back in Pakistan. So I have older sisters on both sides, and a younger brother and sister from my dad and his first wife. So, So they met each other in Texas. They got married. There were a lot of religious differences. My mom was a diehard Pentecostal and very evangelical at that. My father was a practicing Muslim, but more, you know, there's a lot of cultural elements. This was also in like the late 80s, mid late 80s when they met each other. So so that they kind of, you know, things picked off from there. Their marriage didn't last very long. By the time I was about 2 to 3, they were divorced. And my mom actually didn't want him and his family to have any influence on us. I'm not sure why she married a Muslim in the first place, considering her beliefs, but she did for some reason. And so she didn't want them to have any influence over us. And so she actually kind of took us away, and we lived in Wyoming. So, and while we were there, we're actually in a very small insular Pentecostal community. And then that lasted until I was about 8 or so. And we didn't have any contact with my father. During that time, we actually found out later that he had passed away. So he wasn't even searching for us, but my mom didn't know that. And she kind of kept us away and hidden because she wanted to make sure that we grew up with her beliefs. And that's what she did. So we ended up moving back to Texas because my grandfather got sick. And so she went to take care of him. And a few years later is when we found out that my father had actually passed away because she came in contact with one of his acquaintances when she was out one day. And which is part of why she had left Texas in the first place. She didn't want to run into people they knew. And the Pakistani community is like, especially back then, they all knew each other because there wasn't actually, that was kind of like the start of immigration from Pakistan. That was still early days. So a lot of people knew each other. And so she was afraid of being found. And it eventually happened. But by that time, I was 13. And I'll take a little pause in case Janice wants to jump in or...
No, please keep going. It's already so exciting.
Okay. all right. So I feel like the first time, you know, when we've talked a little bit before, it was like so much more animated than, you know, I don't know. I guess retelling your story is maybe it loses a little bit, but hopefully I'm bringing something more to it too. So, all right. During that time, actually, before I even met their family, I had actually gotten involved in missionary work with the church because I grew up, you know, in a Pentecostal community, and it was like the foundation of life. Like everything revolved around this. I was at church or church activities at least four nights a week. So mm-hmm. that was our foundational community. It wasn't even about kids at school or whatever. Like the church was your home and your family. So, I think that just naturally led into doing, missionary work for the church. So it started with, so when we moved back to Texas, we obviously went to a new church, and I think my mother in general strived in like smaller, tight knit communities. We first went back to what became a mega church. When she had been a part of that community decades before, it wasn't a mega church, but, over time it's, it became one. And so, so we went there for a little while. It was very well known, mega church in Austin, and it's no longer actually active. I think that it got bought out by a different community, but it was like the basis of the Pentecostals in Austin, I think. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so we found another community, and it was a smaller church and still lots of people, but more tight-knit. And that's when I started doing missionary work. So it started with a trip to Mexico one summer, and this was with like the youth group. So this was sort of like an introduction to missionary work. So us like, you know, tweens and teenagers, we went on a trip for like a week and a half to the border. And then we would have like, there would be like, you know, lectures and priests like talking, or not priests, but it'd be like all day pastors like talking, like, I'm thinking of like the Islamic words now, but we would have like, what's the English word? It's been a while, but you know, when you're like sitting in like prayer groups and like stuff like that.
Oh, so, like sermons? Were they giving sermons and lectures?
Yeah, sermons and lectures and prayer groups like all day. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, this was quite a while ago. I'm in my 30s now. So so this was kind of how it was though. And then we would go across the border for like day trips, and we would take food to and like gently use clothes to communities on the border. And these were like really very, very poor people. Like it was poverty. It was really intense. And this, I think, is where something sort of first sparked in me, because what I saw when we would go there is that all the people who came to get the food and the clothes and supplies, they had to sit through a sermon before they could receive anything. Mm. And doing this every day for like a week, I started to become aware of it. If we're really going there to do good, why aren't we just giving them the food and like letting them go home? Why are we making them listen to
strings attached?
Yeah, there's strings attached. Exactly. So I think this is where it first started to like, started to think about things a bit more. I'm also my mom's youngest child. So I would, at that point, like the, you know, I had to basically go a lot of places with her. If she wanted to do Christian Bible study stuff, I was sitting there with her in the Bible study with all the adults in their 30s to 50s, and wasn't really an option. It's just what was normal, like, and expected that, oh, you know, oh, I can't stay home alone as like a 10-year-old. So obviously I'm going to go to the sit in the Bible studies. So I learned a lot during those years, through absorption, through, you know, taking notes and participating. And it's just, it was what it was. So that was like kind of the foundational missionary work. And over the next couple of years, like the next summer, I went to, instead of missionary work, I went to a Bible camp, pretty much. Mm-hmm. So we traveled really far, big old bus with all the kids from the church. And this was like for tweens and teens. And we went to this Bible camp. And it was at this Bible camp that I think I was about 12 at this point. And this was the summer. Yeah, my birthday's in the summer. So I was probably about to turn 13. I was about to turn 13. So yeah, it was right before eighth grade. So went to this Bible camp, and I've already done missionary work. I'm so active in the church. I'm really active in the youth group. You know, as a young child, all the adults loved me. I'm so like quiet and obedient and so mature and, you know, has an old soul and all those things that they use when they have a child who's like obedient and, you know, listens and who they are
indoctrinated. Right? Yeah.
Yep. Yep. So I was like a favorite among the adults. And so I went to this like tweens and teens Bible camp, and it was huge. It's like, you're talking mega church, but for like teenagers. And so there we would have these like basically rock concerts every night that were like gospel songs. Right.
Yeah.
And I'm now looking at the time, so I'm got to speed up this part. But basically, at the end of each night, there'd be sermons, like these rock concerts and everything. And then they would say, like, oh, if anyone wants to be saved. And what does that mean for a Pentecostal? It means speaking in tongues, right?
Right.
So you're not actually saved unless you can speak in tongues.
Oh,
and
wow.
At this point, like, which means like God doesn't love you, right? Or like God doesn't accept your sacrifice or like who you are. Like God doesn't accept you essentially if you can't speak in tongues. So like each night I would, they would say after the sermons and the music, anybody wants to be prayed over, anyone wants to be saved, like go to the back of the room. And we went into these like rooms and people would just like pray over us. And like people would lay hands on you, as they say. And so it was just kind of this experience where I would notice after like an hour to an hour and a half, I would be one of the last people in the room every night. And I could never speak in tongues. Mm-hmm. And it was like, I had at least the integrity that I didn't want to fake it. Mm-hmm. And so, but it was demoralizing. It's like, why am I doing all this? And I want to speak in tongues. Why can't I? Like, why, mm-hmm. why doesn't God give me this gift? Like, why not me? So that's where I think the next spark came with me starting to question things. And then I started to look more into like the ideas of original sin, the idea of Jesus as a sacrifice. Does that really make sense? And I'm still at this age where I don't really know very much about Islam or Muslims. It's before we got in contact with the family. And also there, you know, I'm growing up in like Central Texas where there's not a large Muslim population. So there's a lot of Islamophobia and just straight out like disinformation. So I didn't know much about it. All I knew was that what I was being raised in started to not make sense to me. And as I started to question, of course, gently, because we can't really, you know, with how I was being raised, it's hard to go against authority, right? To really be like abrasive. But I started to gently question about original sin, about, oh, where's the justice in that? Like, you know, the idea of Jesus as a sacrifice. And I compared to other sacrifices in the Bible and animal sacrifice and what I knew of the Old Testament. And I never got satisfactory answers. And then the biggest one obviously is the Trinity, the whole concept of the Trinity. And as I got older, I started to actually talk to people about religion, like at school. And I started to notice that people thought about the Trinity in different ways. So if this was something so clear cut, why is there a debate over the very essence of the entire religion? Why mm-hmm. is this even a debate? Why mm-hmm. isn't it clear? Why doesn't, you know, why isn't it understood? Why doesn't everyone agree? This doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. And I somehow got wrapped into another missionary trip. And again, like I was very involved in the youth group, the youth pastor, she loved me. Like I really liked her too. She was a great mentor as a person. Like she was a good mm-hmm. person. And so I was now just turned 13 and this church started fundraising to go to Cambodia and Vietnam. During that time I was helping to fundraise. And then I remember saying to my youth pastor, I was like, oh, I'm going to pull out of the trip, but I'm still going to fundraise to help everyone, which was like, oh, why? And, you know, I grew up with a single mom who didn't do well herself financially. So I was like, oh, I can't afford it. And she's like, you know what? Raise as much as you can. And then I'm going to talk to the church and we can take care of it. And she did. Wow. And I didn't raise very much. I raised maybe like $200. And the minimum for each person to raise was 2000. And that's not how much the trip took. It was more than that. But that's what each person on the trip had to raise for themselves to go on the trip. And it was a youth trip, which meant I was 13. There was a 16-year-old, a couple 17-year-olds, an 18-year-old, and then everyone else was in their like 20s. I think the oldest person there might have been like 28. But it's like we were like a group of like 10 people. And it's like, what is a 13-year-old doing going on an international trip?
That is crazy.
Yeah. And the goal of this trip was to smuggle Bibles over the border of Cambodia into Vietnam.
Oh my God.
Why would a mother allow her 13-year-old to do this in the first place? I have no idea. Danger. I don't even know how this happened. But it did. It's like, I don't even know if there was permission asked. It was just assumed like, yeah, this is happening. Like, I don't know, but I did. And it was on that trip that I essentially told myself, look, I'm doing all of this stuff for Jesus, because my doubts and everything just kept growing. And I still couldn't speak in tongues. Questions weren't answered. And so I was like, all right, I'm going to go on this trip, but I'm doing all this stuff for Jesus, for God. Why am I not a believer yet? Enough, at least. Why am I not enough? Why can't I speak in tongues? And I was like, okay, if I don't have my answers or I don't feel something in my heart by the time this trip is over, then I'm no longer a Christian. And that's essentially what happened. So maybe another time we can go even more into the missionary work and everything. But again, there was a lot of strings attached to when we would go and we'd give gifts and money and food to like different communities. We visited orphanages as well. We obviously smuggled Bibles. That was a big part of the entire trip. And, but there was still like a bit of that strings attached stuff, which I didn't like. And at the end of that trip, I decided for myself at that point, I was like, I remember sitting there in the hotel room thinking, okay, I'm no longer a Christian. I think I kind of believe in God. I don't really know. And I'm no longer going to say in Jesus' name, because that part doesn't make sense to me. This whole Trinity thing, that doesn't make sense to me. The idea of a God, okay, that makes sense to me, sure. And it was, that's kind of how it was. And so then a few months later is when we come in contact with my paternal family. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break. That's a good segue. Any thoughts or questions?
No, I think it's, so you had been raised in your mom's family to be very devout Christian Pentecostal, but even, you know, in your early teens, you were recognizing it didn't make sense to you. And so you were pulling back from that, because even at that age, you were a person of integrity, not wanting to fake something that wasn't real, like as far as the speaking in tongues, which of course is a requirement pretty much for the Pentecostal sect. And so now you've just come to the point where you've said, okay, yeah, I really don't believe most of this anymore. And now you're starting to have contact with your paternal Muslim family back in Pakistan.
Actually, so many of them were in the UK. My father was the oldest son, and he had immigrated to the US, but two of his younger siblings got married and moved to the UK. And his next brother that was younger also later came to the US, but he was between the US and Canada. And so we kind of followed in his footsteps. He didn't take a second wife. His wife was back in Pakistan. So a lot of the family is actually based in the UK. They had, you know, lots of kids. So I got so many cousins. And then also at that time, two of my older sisters that were from Pakistan, they were like 16 and 17 at this point. Or no, they were 17 and 18 at this point. And they had gotten married to, so it is very common in Pakistani culture for cousins and distant relatives to marry each other. So I know that there's a lot of people who are going to probably be hating on that. You know, it's not my choice. It's what people did. Essentially, like, it was cousins or second cousins marrying cousins, like people within the family. And they would just bring them over from Pakistan to the UK and then had lots of babies. And the cycle kind of continues. It was never the case where cousins who grew up together would marry each other.
Right.
But they were first cousins, but one grew up in Pakistan and one grew up in the UK, then that did happen that some of them would marry each other. So two of my half sisters had already moved to the UK. They had married my aunt's sons. And so, yeah, there's a lot more to the family dynamics and drama, but I don't feel like we don't have too much time, so I won't harp on that too much. But essentially, a lot of them are in the UK. And the uncle, the oldest uncle, he was currently in Canada when we all got in touch with each other. And he paid for us to go to the UK that summer, that upcoming summer. And then we got to meet the family.
And your siblings from your mom?
Just me and my, so my mom came later. Me and my brother. So he's actually my full brother, mm-hmm. but we are no longer in touch. So I don't talk about him very much, mm-hmm. but he was a part of that part of the story. Yeah.
But your mom had no problem putting you on a plane to go to the UK to spend time with the Muslim relatives who she had, you know, feared previously might pull you away from Christianity.
Yeah. So I think all my missionary work that I had done in the past like 6 months kind of convinced her, I guess, that I was still on that path. Mm-hmm. And she also said part of why she was afraid before is that she thought he was going to fight for custody. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he had passed away and we were going to the UK, not Pakistan. So she did feel more confident about us going there because there's a lot more protection than us going to Pakistan. And in Pakistan, the father would have more rights and his family would have more rights over the children. But in the UK, we're American citizens and that's just not going to happen. So I think that she kind of felt safer. Mm-hmm. And they also offered to take her too, but we flew first. We went for the first I think it was like a 2 month trip. For the first like few weeks or a month, it was just my brother and I. And also my brother, he's a year and a half older. And so he was already starting to have like a lot of behavioral issues. And my mom thought it would be good for him to connect with the family and have like male examples. And all it really did was sort of, he got to see how shitty the boys got to behave and get away with everything.
Then
the girls have to like stay in line. So it sort of just solidified his bad behavior and expectations around he can do whatever he wants. So again, a whole nother story. but I think that she thought it would be healthy for him and it wasn't. And there was a lot of culture shock, obviously. I won't stand on that for too long. Lots of culture shock. It was things were weird and everything. The oldest uncle came to live in Texas the following year. And then my brother like was on and off living with him and at home with us. And so trying to like get him on to a stable, like secure path. So that didn't work out so well. But so it skipped 2 years and then I went the two summers later. I think the first time there was a lot of culture shock. It was upsetting in some ways. It was weird. It was uncomfortable, you know, for someone 13 going on 14. It was a lot to handle, but also there was a lot of expectations that, oh, your dad's Muslim, and so you have to be Muslim too. And I felt that pressure, and I didn't like it.
And did you push back against it? Did you say, no, I'm Christian, or I'm not going to be Muslim?
That's exactly what I said. Because when one religion tries to convert you, you can't just say, oh, I'm not sure what I believe, because then they're going to try harder. Mm-hmm. So I just said, oh, I'm a Christian. And even though I wasn't even at that point, but I was like, I'm not going to become a Muslim. Like, what, these terrorists? Like, that's how I thought, like, as a child. Mm-hmm. And then I started to learn more. I started to be more open-minded about things. So I'll speed up a little bit.
And you had a second trip out there.
I did. Yeah. And that one was when I was 15 going on 16. And that's the summer that I converted. To Islam. Yeah. There is so much to say about that, but I'll keep it short. So my father's first cousin. So it was like his uncle's son, like his direct first cousin, grew up in the UK, very British. He had become a sheikh, and which is like a pastor, basically. And he studied in Medina, which is like the center of like Salafi, or some people might know Wahhabi Islam. So Salafi is like the term that they'll use for themselves, referring to themselves as like people who follow the original Muslims, like the right path. Right. Uh-huh. So I basically went from one extreme group to another extreme group because that's what made sense. That if you're going to follow a religion, like what is this half-assing it? Like, no, you got to pray all five times a day. You got to do this. I said the Shahada, which is the declaration of faith. And I literally put on a scarf and I got ready to pray with everyone. Even though I didn't know how, I went through the motions and they taught me. So that's when I started to learn how to, you know, speaking Arabic, understanding the words I'm saying, the prayer and all of that. So things kind of escalated for me. I embraced it all the way. It took a while to get me to that point. There's a lot of conversations, lots of debates with the sheikh. I would sit and talk with him and debate with him. And then I had this like dream, which I won't go into now, maybe another time, but I had this dream that the sheikh liked to interpret in a way that made it sound like, yeah, I mean, actually it did feel like that I'm like, oh, I'm supposed to save myself from the fire and like and embrace Islam. And so I said the Shahada.
So much pressure. Like yeah, you were so under just such intense pressure. Yeah. And it was a time in your life where you're particularly susceptible to peer pressure when we're in our teens, and you already were coming out of an extreme background. So you were primed to think in extreme terms. And then that's exactly what happened.
It, to be honest, like he actually groomed me. There was a lot more to this. And there's so much to say about these sort of situations, but I came from a vulnerable position and he pushed his agenda basically. And there was, there's a lot more, but eventually, I did become Muslim and I went, it took me some convincing. And then once I was convinced, it was like gung ho, like all the way. And when I got back to the US, I took off my scarf on the plane before I got on the plane, because I didn't want to like give my mom a heart attack. And also there's that like, that, you know, little kid in you who, I don't want people to be disappointed in me. And there's trauma related to like being pressured into things. Yeah. And so, and I think that's also part of why I was pressured into accepting the Shahada too, because this much older man who was very distinguished and knew how to talk and he was very charismatic, he knew how, what to say and how to say what he said to convince me to do what he wanted me to do, right? And then also as a teenager, like sometimes you get little crushes on people and you do stupid, like you, it's not even just like, I obviously didn't convert for him. It was very much an internal thing, but I was more easily susceptible to it when I'm having this handsome man give me all of this attention. And again, that comes in with the grooming later and some things that were inappropriate that happened.
And let's just remind folks too that we would never, in a court of law, it would never stand up for a child or a minor to make some kind of legally binding, I got my air quotes, oath, covenant, pledge, agreement, promise. But that's exactly what's encouraged in the Christian churches at altar calls, or you hear these moms saying, oh, my four-year-old just said the sinner's prayer. Again, in your situation then as a teenager, our brains haven't fully developed yet. Yeah. And we're so susceptible to pressure, and we don't have the critical thinking abilities to discern these truth claims that adults are feeding to us. So, but we don't know that. We just know that our heart feels something.
Yeah. And what's crazy is that it was like my logic brain that was saying, well, it doesn't have the problems that Christianity did, right? There's no Trinity. There's no original sin.
No speaking in tongues.
No speaking in tongues, right? It's just about what you believe and what you do. And Islam is a very deed-oriented religion. Are you doing good deeds? Are you following the rules? Are you doing X, Y, Z? Are you not doing these things? It's very, like, literally they talk about scales to get into heaven. Do your good deeds outweigh your bad deeds? It's not a black and white. There's more balance to it, which is appealing, actually, because it makes you think, oh, I can erase bad things I've done by doing good things.
Right.
And it's, and that's part of what got me into it was that, okay, I couldn't speak in tongues, but you know, it doesn't have any of those problems that Christianity had. And yet it feels very familiar. Like it has all the same prophets. It has a lot. They both have the Old Testament. That foundation was basically the same, but my issues weren't really there. And at that age, I didn't know enough to really argue against more of it. Right. I started reading the Quran actually to refute it. And while I was reading, I was like, okay, it's a religious book. I don't really have something against it. Like I haven't found I started reading for mistakes, because that's what I did with the Bible too. Like looking for where are the inconsistencies, where are the errors. And as a 16-year-old, 15 at that point, I didn't see them. I didn't find those things. And I wasn't educated enough to really make that choice, but I did it. And I went all the way in. And within 6 months, I was not only wearing a scarf and a abaya, I was also wearing a niqab across my face.
At living high school?
In high school. And I was the only Muslim in my school of like 2,000 kids.
Oh my gosh. What was your mom saying?
There were a lot of arguments and fights that happened during this time. She almost like tried to kick me out. I stayed with my sister for a little bit. And she had her own place. She's like 9-10 years older than me, so she was more established, obviously. There was a lot of arguing. Mm-hmm. And I think there were multiple discussions. One of them, her being like, "Oh, your blood is on my hands because you're a child and you don't know what the between right and wrong. Like, so your blood is on my hands." And then I just threw back in her face, like, "If it's my blood on your hands, then, you know," and then I'm listing my siblings, like, "Their blood is on your hands for all this crap they do, right? Because I'm the good kid." Mm. I'm not having premarital sex. I'm not doing drugs. I'm literally like talking about God. And you're saying my blood is on your hands. Like, mm. I'm the good one. I'm the one who goes to school, who doesn't skip, who does all whatever. I'm going to college one day. Like, what the hell kind of thing. So that's when my teenage rebellion finally started to pop up. So that kind of finally happened there. And so one thing that I think got through to her, though, because she was taking it very personally, was she said something like, okay, so I think it was Mother's Day, and this was after I had started wearing niqab. And we went to eat, when we would go out to restaurants, I would like lift it a little bit and I would put the food like this underneath. And so yeah. I'd sit by a wall so that I could like eat at a restaurant. And my mom was embarrassed about this. We didn't go out very often anyway, but when we did, like, that's how I would eat. And so it was Mother's Day coming up and she's like, "Oh, we're going to go out." And I was like, "Oh, I don't want to go." And I'm saying it very sweetly and nicely. "Oh, I don't want to go." And she was like, "Why not?" And I was like, I just kept insisting, "Oh, I'm going to just stay home. I hope you have a good time. Happy Mother's Day." And then she's like, "Well, why don't you want to go?" And I said, "Look, like, I want to dress like this and this is what I'm wearing. And I'm not going to take it off so we can eat in public. And I'm also not trying to embarrass you. And I know that you feel embarrassed and you get upset when I eat like that. So it's better if I just stay home. So you don't get embarrassed and I don't have to take it off." And I think finally it hit her that it wasn't about her. It wasn't a rebellion. It wasn't about like sticking it to her or something. Mm-hmm. And then she finally kind of understood. And she thought for a minute, she's like, "No, I don't like it that you wear that, but I want you to come and I want to spend the day with you. And I'm not going to say anything about it." And after that, I think there was a shift. We'd still get in some religious debates, but there was definitely a shift where she started to understand I wasn't just rebelling. It wasn't that simple. Mm-hmm. It was something I believed and I had a firm belief in. So, that's kind of how that happened there.
Oh, and then you graduated and then you ended up leaving the United States to go do some Islamic studies abroad. So you were really like steeped and totally immersed full speed ahead in this whole thing. Can you tell us a little bit about what got you out of it? And I think if it's okay with you, what we'll probably end up doing is I'd love to have you back again. Okay. And we'll do part two of this. But tell us a little bit more.
Okay. Will part two be going into more detailed things I left out, or will it be expanding on the story? Because I'm thinking, should I cut it or should I do an overview and then go in depth next time?
So for today, maybe just get us to the point where you started questioning your Islamic beliefs. Okay. And then next time we'll just do a little recap and then you'll take us from that point on, because I do also then in our next episode I want you to share about Anas as well.
Okay, that sounds great. And we have about 15 minutes, right?
Yes, we sure do. So yeah, keep on going.
Okay. All right. So even before I can get to the part of questioning Islam is when I got to college. Okay. Also, I'm a millennial. I probably look a little young on the screen, but I'm a millennial. So I grew up with computers were just becoming a thing when I was in high school. Right. And I didn't even have a smartphone until I got to college. I think the iPhones first started to become popular and well-known when I was like a freshman in college, maybe senior year, but I had a flip phone and I got that when I was like 15, like that was normal back then. But this was also the start of like chat rooms and AIM.
Right.
And that was like the start of that. So I started to build community online, because I was out, like I was in Texas, but I was kind of outside the city. So I wasn't able to go to the mosque very much. I did go some a little bit, but I didn't really have the freedom to until I got to college. And during that time, like I got into this like very deep hole of like, oh, I'm a Salafi and like, I'm so certain. And it's actually very common among Salafis to have this like arrogance about them being on the right path and everyone else being wrong. So much so that, so there's like two major groups in Islam, two major divisions. Historically, there's Sunni and there's Shia. And Sunnis are the overall overarching group, right? And Shia are an overarching group. And then within each one, you have further divisions. And so Salafis are a type of Sunni Muslim. And okay. They're the extreme version, just similar to like Protestants and Catholics. Same basic concept. There's Sunnis and Shia. And then there's debates even about the origin text and everything, because it happened pretty early on, historically speaking. So Salafis are like the extreme verse of Sunnis, and they don't even believe that Shia Muslims as a whole are Muslim. They don't believe that they're Muslim at all. And so something that Muslims do when they greet each other, it's literally like required that you meet a Muslim and you say Assalamu Alaikum. And you can shorten it to Salam, but like you have to say to them Assalamu Alaikum, which means peace be on you. And then the other person must respond. If you hear someone say salams to you, you have to respond Wa Alaikum Assalam, which means, and peace be on you. This is something Muslims say to other Muslims. You don't say this to non-Muslims. Okay. This is not something you say to them. It's only Muslim to Muslim, and it's a requirement. Like, it's literally a sin if you don't say the salams to someone or return it to them, to Muslim.
Oh, it's a sin if
it's
you don't.
Sin. It's a sin. Wow, okay. Yeah, it's considered like a sin, yeah. Shia Muslims, because Salafis don't consider them Muslim, they would not give them salams or respond to their salams.
Whoa.
Yeah, like that's how extreme it is. There's even like a hadith, which is like a hadith is basically a saying that's attributed to the Prophet having once said it. So it's like there's the Quran, which is allegedly the words of God, right? And then there's everything the Prophet said about the religion that isn't in the Quran. Basically. So we call this hadith. So there's a hadith, which means just like one little snippet or one little story that says, basically for whoever doesn't, because it's talking about this like idea of like religion and belief and stuff. So it's like, trying to remember how it's said. It's like, whoever doesn't return the salam or doesn't give the salams to a believer, that is upon them. Essentially what it was saying is like, if you are calling another Muslim a disbeliever and don't give them salams, then, and if they're not a disbeliever, then you're the disbeliever.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it's like that, that's part of the whole thing. I'm saying all this because it's related to the story. So senior year of high school, I start getting really interested in, I go into more chat rooms and I stumble across like some Shia Muslims online. And of course I automatically call them a kafir, which means a non-believer. And cause I was a very arrogant child who believed in what I was, what I believed. I didn't say it actually in a rude way. I wasn't even being mean. I was just like, oh, cause you're not Muslims. Like it was just like, oh, obviously, it was one of those sort of things. And started to like learn about them and getting to know them a little bit. And I was like, oh, maybe I'm wrong. Like maybe I don't actually know what I'm talking about, because I became friends with some of them. I was like, oh, they seem like Muslims. They pray, they do all the same stuff as we do. So why wouldn't they be Muslims? Started talking to people at the mosque, that sort of stuff. I get to college and there's this guy who takes notice of me, and I noticed him too because we're on the bus. There's like this bus that goes around the campus, and we apparently actually live close to each other, and my roommates know his roommates from high school, and so it's like there's a very strong connection. And he happens to be Shia, and he was very religious, and because I was wearing the niqab, he was like really interested in me, like in terms of marriage. He's not trying to like chat me up, he's trying to like marry me.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. It moves pretty fast when you're Muslim. So that's a long story, but basically I started talking to him, and then I learned even more about Shia Islam. And then before the end of my freshman year, I decided I wanted to become Shia. And so I again convert, but it was during this process that, during this process, do you remember the Sheikh who originally led me in Shahada and like groomed me a little bit? I was still in touch with him a bit. And so I started getting these questions, and a lot of these questions, they weren't about belief anymore, like the way my issues were with Christianity. It was about literal words within the text and the history of like who was correct and who was wrong and how they interpreted the Quran and which hadith were considered authentic and not authentic, because Sunnis and Shias have different collections of these hadith based on who they believed were the correct ones to collect the text from the prophet.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, my issue here was more like fact-based. And there was like a Sunni hadith that basically said something about the age of Aisha. In the West, there's a lot of controversy about the Prophet Muhammad having a child bride. Right. And it's generally accepted within most Sunni Muslims that Aisha was 6 when she got married, but 9 when she consummated the marriage. So a 9-year-old being married to a man in his like 50s. And it's something known and accepted. But among Shia Muslims, she was 16 when she got married and she was 19 when she consummated the marriage. And so it's not even about like making the prophet look good, because in modern standards, he's a pedophile regardless. But it was about, well, which text is actually correct? Why is it that Sunni Muslims believe this age and why do Shia Muslims believe this age? That was just one of the issues. There was a couple other things, but it was just a very like fact-based thing. Like who is like, what's the correct thing? And I was also a religious studies major, was one of my majors in college. And I modeled I was in the honors program, so I had to write a thesis. And it was about like Islamic history from a historical perspective and developmental perspective. And so one of the things I talked about was the age of Aisha. And I go back to the sheikh and I'm like, I'm talking to him about this, about the inconsistency with the hadith. And this is a really big deal to me. He just acted like it was nothing. And he's like, we don't need to be concerned with these small things. Like this is such a minute question. Like it doesn't matter. It's like such a small thing in the grand scale of things, but it really shook my faith. It really like, I think at that point, that's what broke my confidence in religion period. Cause it's like, okay, the first time I grew up in something, it's all I knew, but then I embraced this new thing. And it was like, it was everything to me. It was my whole life, like my whole identity. There's so many things I sacrificed. I didn't go to my high school graduation because it was considered an innovation in Islam, like Islam terms, which is, it was like an imitation of the kufar, of the unbelievers, right? Damn. I didn't go to my high school graduation. I got rid of like my childhood stuffed animals because Islam, Salafi Muslims specifically say you can't have anything with a face on it because it's like, you're trying to imitate God's creation. There's like, really big thing. I changed my entire life for this. Yeah. And then that conversation and me like bringing these concerns to someone who has literally studied for like 12 years, was a very like knew what he's talking about. And he just brushed it off like it's nothing. And then eventually he admitted that there was an inconsistency in the text, that in Sunni text, there is this age too, but what's generally accepted. And knowing and finally understanding where does the religion come from? It's not just the Quran. It's about all of these men, literally men, not even women, all of these men over the centuries with power, reading texts and deciding who they want to follow based on what they think. Literally their opinions. That's it. It's their opinions. And during this time, I was learning so much more about even Christianity and the origin, because I was a religious studies major and I was also a history major. So a lot of my religious studies classes were historical based because that was an easy way to get both while not staying in school for like 5 years. And so I also learned about the development of Christianity and how like the Council of Nicaea and people, literally men, again, men coming together and based on their opinions, creating religious texts. And I was just like, what's even the difference here? But at that point, I don't think I was ready to leave religion. I was still like 19 going on 20. I was like 18 going on 19, but I embraced Shia Islam, but I didn't have that arrogance that I had before. I didn't have that really, there's like an Islamic word we call it yaqeen, which is certainty, like 100% certainty. I didn't have it anymore. And that really, I think that's at the basis for me to question religion altogether just a few years later. And I see that we're coming up to the end point. So I just want to give you a chance to check in.
amazing. You went through so many transitions in such a short time. I mean, this is, you're only 18 or 19 at the most at this point, and you've already just been primed to see things in a certain way. And then, I mean, it's really challenging when we grow up in a home with parents or a parent who is very devout in their beliefs, because that limits their openness to other ways of being and interpretation. Oh, yeah. It's like Definitely. You have these goggles stuck to your face. And so everything you see and experience is interpreted through the lenses of those particular goggles. Yeah. Yeah. And you were without a dad at that point. And then there were issues with brother also. So different things going on.
Yeah.
You lose your Christian faith, and then you embrace this other faith that your other relatives have, and you are so earnest in both the situations. You were equally yeah. earnest, like just yeah. really wanting to know the truth yeah. so that you could live according to the truth. And I think that's a beautiful thing. And in some ways, I think that is one of the powers of youth, you know, the innocence of yeah. youth. We oh, think yeah. that there is one right way, and we just have to find that.
Right. There's only one path, right? It'll all make sense once I find it, right? Just yes. this one way. There's yeah. one.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And yeah. so we think that way, and then you give up things, you sacrifice things as a measure of your devotion to this ideology. And yeah. then now, as you're studying religion and history, and this is a point where I think a lot of people actually end up having a break with their own religious faith when mm-hmm. they start recognizing, oh, guess what? I think some of this, if not a lot of it, might actually just be recycled from previous iterations of religions. Yeah. And I mean, humans crave certainty, security, order, and acceptance. And yeah. all religions
at that age.
Tie that up. That's right. Yep. Tie it up yep. with the bow. And so do conspiracy theories, these different mm-hmm. ideologies. And then we feel accepted, you know, we're love bombed. And then we think we have the secret sauce, the only yeah. truth. And yep. all these things make it really hard for us then to step back and really question whether it is true or not. So
yeah. Yep.
Wow. You've been through it.
Yeah. Well, when we get to part two, I'll expand on that story when I started about the salams, about Muslims greeting each other. It's related to this the shift to being Shia Muslim. So and how I was basically excommunicated from the Salafi mosque. So I'll go into that in part two, though.
Wow. I can't wait. I'm so grateful to you for spending time with me today and sharing your incredible, amazing story with my viewers and listeners here at the Divorcing Religion podcast. And I will include links when I do the show notes to the Annas organization. And also I'll share a link for the Rights and Religions Forum, telling people about the Borgenick Fellowship. And I look forward to seeing you again, talking with you again soon to find out the rest of the story.
Yeah, of course. I'm happy to tell it.
Wonderful. Okay, everyone, stay tuned. Be back again soon with part two. Take care.